This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more details, see jodcast.net.
We have lots of Asking Astronomer questions to catch up on this week, so we're going to launch straight into it. So the first question is from David Wilson. He says, I've seen definitions of dark matter described as non-baryonic, and of course dark matter is stuff that we can't see. And his question regards black holes. He says, does the core of a black hole count as baryonic or non-baryonic? I know the event horizon can emit radiation, but not the matter inside it. Therefore, would not the matter inside black holes be regarded as dark matter?
Well, as to does the core of a black hole count as baryonic or non-baryonic, I would say that the core of a black hole is actually non-baryonic. And that's because baryons is basically the stuff that's made up by quarks. And the way we think about black holes is that they are singularity. And I can't imagine that you would still have quarks in such a state. So, no, I don't think you can say that the core of a black hole consists of baryonic matter. As to the question whether that would be regarded as dark matter is actually introduced to explain gravitational behavior in galaxies and then between galaxies that is suggesting that there's more matter than we can actually see. And because we can't see it, we think it doesn't interact electrodynamically, and therefore it is non-baryonic. So there's two different things here. And I don't think that because both of it is non-baryonic, you can simply say that it's the same stuff. They're just two different things that are non-baryonic. But you can ask the question if black holes could actually explain this gravitational behavior. So could black holes still be dark matter? And that doesn't seem very likely, as you would need a huge amount of black holes to explain this behavior. And we can't explain so many black holes by any reasonable theory of stellar or galactic evolution. And if you did have so many black holes, then you would be able to see them as microlensing popping up all the time. So microlensing is basically the idea that the gravity of a heavy star or black hole acts like a lens, so you can see that something that's behind it gets lensed by the gravitational effects. We can see these things sometimes, occurring sometimes, but if black holes would be the explanation of all the dark matter, there would be so many black holes we would see microlensing all the time everywhere. And we don't do that, so therefore I would say no, black holes are not dark matter.
The second question is from Great Old Mac, and it's about a phenomenon called auroral kilometric radiation, or AKR, the most powerful emission of terrestrial origin that is beamed into space. Now we know that Saturn and Jupiter also emit AKR, and this tells us about the magnetic environment of the planets. And it's also proposed that a search for planets around other stars could involve a search for this radiation. So the question is, do you know of any proposal or program with Merlin or VLBI to detect planets using this method, or have indeed any planets already been detected from AKR? And what would this radiation sound like?
Yeah, that's a very good question. As far as I know, no planets have been detected by this method so far. And I think one of the reasons for that is that the frequencies of this emission typically lies well below 100 megahertz, and for most telescopes this is not achievable. I don't think Merlin can achieve such low frequencies, so I don't think there's a proposal for Merlin to look for that. Some new telescopes that are coming online, especially a telescope called LOFA, Low Frequency Array, which is currently being built in the Netherlands, should be very promising for this, and I think there is a proposal for LOFA to actually look for exoplanets in this matter, because it has a large collecting area, so it's a very sensitive telescope, and it also operates at very low frequencies, which should be suitable for finding these things. Another telescope that will come online a little bit further along the pipeline, around 2020, is the SKA, the Square Kilometer Array, which also have a low frequency end, and since it will have even more collecting area, the SKA will probably be able to find those planets with this method as well. But as far as I know, at the moment, no planet can be found with this method. What does it sound like? Well, actually, last year, I think it's August extra edition of 2008, Tim O'Brien introduced us to several sounds from the cosmos. These aren't actual sounds, these are radio waves from the cosmos, which you can transfer into sound waves, so we can hear what they sound like. And he actually has some examples in that episode of whistlers and chirps, which are caused by this auroral kilometric radiation. So if you have a listen to August extra edition of 2008, then you can find out what it sounds like.
Third question is from Hugh Hassard-Jones. He saw the ISS flying over Liverpool at 3 minutes past midnight on the 13th of July, and he saw something preceding it in the sky. It wasn't the shuttle, and he asks, what was it?
I actually don't know. It would be interesting to have more information on what this looked like. Was it something that actually moved along with the ISS, or was it maybe a planet that was on the background? If it was moving along, I did look up a picture on the internet from that same evening, where they actually showed the trail of the ISS. It was a many second exposure, and there was nothing else there, it was just the ISS. So whatever it was, several hours later in the evening, it wasn't there anymore. But I do know that they sometimes send supplies in huge containers by using a rocket, and at some point they'll have to eject it, and maybe you can see that, and maybe that was what he was seeing. Would be nice to know more information on exactly what he saw and what it looked like to be able to say if that was it.
The fourth question comes from Jeff Walker. It's about a supposed comet or planet approaching the Earth, which he has heard is due to interfere with our orbit in December 2012. And he asks, is this a hoax or is it real?
It's a hoax. The world is not going to end in 2012, and there's no known comet or planet going to interfere with Earth's orbit around that time, or as far as we know, any other time. This is simply one of those many hoaxes about the end of the world, and in this case it's one about 2012. And the main reason that the year 2012 is these days often quoted as the end of the world is that, well, first of all, it's because if you say it's before 2009, nobody's going to believe you. I know there were several predictions in 2008 that the world was going to end, but that didn't happen. So obviously you have to put it somewhere in the near future to make it interesting. But 2012, and especially December 2012, is special because it is the end of the Mayan calendar. And this is simply a consequence of the way they count. So on December 20th, 2012, they reach a date that they indicate as 12.19.19.17.19. That is where their calendar stops. And the next day on their calendar, if they would add one day to that, that would be December 21st, 2012 for us, their number would then be 13.0.0.0.0. They don't go that far, they simply stop the calendar at that nice round number. So there's no real physical meaning to the number itself, it's just a number that happens to fall in December 2012 for us. And actually, as far as we know, there's not a single clue that the Magians believed that this had anything to do with the end of the world. It's simply the way as far as their calendar goes. So it is simply something that people made up afterwards, just like hundreds of other end-of-the-world predictions that didn't come true either. So everybody can relax and stop worrying about their vacation plans in 2013. And now, of course, the idea that a big object from space will kill us all is also nothing new. We've been seeing this kind of things a lot in Hollywood movies, for example. But the odds of that actually happening within, say, the next thousands of years, the odds of that are astronomically small. But, you know, large numbers, they don't mean anything to people. So when you tell them that it is technically possible, even though the odds are very small, if you say it's technically possible, then you can get people to panic already. Luckily, these days, we do have a pretty good idea of anything big out there that could possibly hit us someday. So, yes, we can see these big objects that might be a threat. So, but whether we could actually do anything about it will depend on the exact situation. When we find an object in collision course with the Earth, maybe we can do something about it, maybe we're hopelessly lost, that's very hard to say. But when you put all the odds together, the chances that the world would actually come to an end in 2012 due to a big object from space, that's just completely negligible.
The next question comes from Gary Brannigan, who was listening to the March 2009 Extra Jodcast, and is fascinated by LISA, the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna, which is intended to detect gravitational waves. And he asks if the sun's gravitational field would also affect the detector. He says, I know that the Earth's gravitational field varies due to the density of the underlying rocks, and I thought that the sun might have the same effects going on.
Yeah, I do think that the sun's gravitational field will change in time due to just the convex nature of the inside of the sun. Well, the question is whether will this have a significant effect on LISA? Well, of course, obviously, LISA is an extremely sensitive instrument, so maybe it does have an effect. I haven't done the calculations on that, so I don't know. So the way LISA works is by looking at the tiniest changes in the path length of three laser beams. So LISA has three components, there are three laser beams, and the slightest change in path can be seen by LISA because they look at the interference at the interaction point of two laser beams. And when a gravitational wave passes, then what it will do is, depending on the direction that the gravitational wave travels, one of the beams will have a slightly smaller or larger travel length, so it'll change the phase at the interaction point. So nothing else changes, just the path length of these laser beams. Now, if you would have a changing gravitational field, if that would be significant, then that would result in an acceleration in the satellites themselves. And that is slightly different from actually just changing the path length. So I imagine that the people who engineered LISA engineered it such that any kind of acceleration from solar wind or changing gravitational fields would be measured, and you can take this into account so that you can, in the end, measure only the path length difference in the laser beams. So I would think that since these are two different effects, that it would not affect the detection of a gravitational wave by LISA.
The next question is from Andrew Tizak, and he says, my friend and I recently watched Apollo 13, which we both enjoyed. During the film, we began to wonder why it took a massive Saturn V rocket to get out from the Earth's gravitational pull, but a mere lunar lander to leave the Moon and go back to the Earth. As the Moon's gravity is about one-sixth of the Earth's, why didn't the astronauts need a spacecraft one-sixth the size and power of a Saturn V rocket?
So that assumes that the amount of fuel basically scales linear with the amount of gravity of the planet or Moon you're trying to leave. And that is simply not the case. Well, first of all, you have to realize that if you have to take extra fuel because the Earth has a larger gravitational pull, then all that extra fuel you're going to take with you, part of that has to escape from Earth, so you need extra energy for that, which means you have to add extra fuel, and also that fuel needs to be transported up to a certain height. So it's a very complex formula that would actually tell you how much fuel you need. And the more mass you're trying to launch and the more gravity you're trying to overcome, the amount of fuel you need for that really goes up really quickly with those numbers. It also depends on the outflow of the gas that you're using to accelerate. So the whole thing is quite complex. You can make some easy assumptions and get some estimates on what amount of fuel you need to take with you. I did try to derive something, a simple equation that does that. And when you put some reasonable numbers in there, I found that the Saturn V rocket needs to carry roughly about 200 times as much as the lunar lander.
The last question is from Julie Walsh. She says, on Sunday the 9th, that's the 9th of August, at about 11 p.m, there was an orange fireball in the sky. This was so bright that she at first thought it was a plane that was on fire. She says, I recorded what looked like the Moon moving across the sky. I am intrigued as to what I might have seen and would like to find out what it was, possibly a Perseid meteor.
Yeah, it could have been a Perseid meteor, so we call that a fireball. So the peak of the Perseid meteor shower was in August 12th, which is 3 days after she saw this. And I do remember people reporting seeing a fireball around that time, so it could have been a fireball. And it would be nice to actually see the video recordings to be sure about that. An alternative could be that it was one of these Chinese lanterns, which we've had many reports of, people seeing these things and calling them UFOs and all other things. So these days astronomers are quite keen, whenever somebody comes, I saw something in the sky, they say, oh, it must have been a Chinese lantern. But it doesn't always have to be, of course, the case. Since it was so very close to the Perseid meteor shower, it could very well have been a fireball, although they are very rare. But I do know that at least one did occur. Maybe that was it.
Okay, thanks, Roy.